So I'm working on a complex piece of code. It's a combination of it being a little bit complex and my brain being off somewhere else and sort of having trouble getting into the groove of this thing. But, you know, you like to develop, the ideal for developing code is that the code itself reads like pseudocode. And pseudocode is what you write when you sort of need to figure out what the code is going to do and how it's going to be organized, more than actually having code that you could feed to the computer and have it execute and do the actual thing that you want it to do. Because you need to think about it at that level, at a very high level, before trying to implement it. It's a technique. It's something, actually I don't do it very often, because as I've gotten more experienced, I can sort of do it in my brain without actually having to make something visual external, because I've seen most of the patterns, pretty much all the patterns before, and that has taken some time in JavaScript, because it has patterns that no other language requires you to have, because you're doing things that the machine can do for you. It could do it for you in JavaScript too, the whole callback hell and async, whatever, promises, all that stuff is just unnecessary. The computer totally should be doing all that for you and allowing you to write the code in the most natural way possible, because that's why we have computers. So that's a little aside. But in JavaScript, your code has to include the question of synchronization. You have to manage that, and that makes it another order of magnitude more complicated if there's any I/O involved. So anyway, so I've got a situation here. I'm not going to go into details on what it is because it's unnecessary, other than the code was already very complicated and there was no way around it. You had to do things that aren't built into the language and they have to be done. And it's when you're reading the code, see, that's the problem is what I want to be, the time that I really need to be able to read pseudocode is when I'm reading. It's not so much when I'm writing, it's when I'm reading that I need it. Why? Because I don't know how many modules of code I've written in the last 10 years. That's what I'm working with, a 10-year-old code base here. I started programming in JavaScript in 2013. I really got going in 2014. And over time, I've gotten very comfortable with it and actually sort of like callback hell, because whatever. What do they call that? The Stockholm Syndrome or something like that, I think is what it's called, where you learn to love your tormentor. You couldn't imagine life without it, you know? No, because so I develop all these things and they have all the complexities in them of having to make, to torture this language into doing exactly what I need to be done here. Realizing, now this is why I picked up the phone right now, is realizing as you're doing it, you're taking a piece of code that's very hard to pick up, to read, just fresh, and making it a lot more difficult to do that with. And then you go, well, is there some way around this? You know, that's what I'm pausing for right here. That's why I wanted to just talk this through a little bit. Is there some, but no. No, there's no way around it. Because there's no level of abstraction that... Yeah, I could probably start from scratch again with this problem. Maybe I might get somewhere with that approach. In other words, let's write this whole function over again. It's a very simple sounding function. It's called view search results. Come on, what could be so hard about viewing the search results? Well, the idea is that when the user actually gets it, it's just going to, they're not even going to have to understand what it did. It's going to just do what it wanted, what the user wanted them to do. That's the way most software has to work these days anyway. People just don't have that much of an attention span. And especially on something like search, what you want them to be doing is focusing on the words on the page, you want the words on the page arranged in the most convenient way for the reader. That's the thing. It's like, you know, if that weren't the goal, then I could like do it really sloppy and say, well, no, I'm sorry, I did put it there on the page. You just have to find it. You know, it's like, not my problem. I took it on as my problem. I want this to be just, I want it to be set a new standard. That's kind of what I'm looking to do here. So then I had a thought, because for the last, to some extent, for the last 2 years using ChatGPT, I've been programming in language that is really easy to understand. I'm writing queries there in my pseudocode, and it's not quite at the point yet where it's a self-driving thing, but I could certainly imagine a programming language. This is the point, by the way. I could certainly imagine designing a programming language that really did have verbs and nouns in them that were well-understood mathematical things, and that you could tell the story using any words you want that make sense to you using those verbs and nouns. So what would the verbs and nouns be? They would be the names for the things that you see on the screen. There's a table there that has a list of all the feeds the user is subscribed to. In the first column, you have a checkbox. In the second column, you have the title of the feed that also is linked to a page of information about the feed. You have, I'm doing this from memory. Let me just actually get this up on the screen here so I can do a better job of narrating this. So here, looking at the feeds page. Yes, next to the name of each feed, there's a bookmark icon. And it's tilted to the left, sort of on an angle. And when you hover on it, it shows you a comma-delimited list of all of the categories that this feed, that you've put this feed into. If you click on the button, if you click on the bookmark icon, you're taken to a dialog pops up that has a list of all of the predefined categories with the checkboxes next to each one. And if that feed is in the category, a checkbox is checked. If it's not, it's unchecked. And when the user clicks on a checkbox, there's no further action required. That feed is added to the category in the database. There's no need to confirm this. So the checkboxes, as everywhere in the product, the checkboxes are live. They're live. In the next column over is the time, an abbreviated date time, abbreviated date time is a noun, a built-in noun. That means something in this language, an abbreviated date time. And it shows when the feed last updated. And then the next column is called count, which is abbreviated in the title as CT. So it can be a very narrow column. And it's the number of times the feed has updated. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. We'll have to check that out. And in the final column in the list or table is an eye inside of a solid circle, which means information about the feed. And when you hover over that icon, you get a pop-up that says how many subscribers, how many times the feed's been checked, how many items have been retrieved from the feed, how many errors, when it was added, when it updated, when it was last checked, when was the last error, what reading list is it in, if it's in a reading list, who added it, and how many seconds did it take to read. I'm going to now pause. Now, I believe that everything that I said, and now I'm talking to you, not the computer. I believe that everything that I said there could easily be parsed by ChatGPT correctly. It would understand and it would record it. And then when I'm defining the next object in this piece of software that I'm writing, I could use the same terms. I would use the same terms, and I would describe how it was related to this list. And then later, maybe 6 months from now, when I've moved on and done all kinds of other things, and I'm coming back here, and all I have to go by now is my usage, my memory of having used this feature, which I've used many, many times since I wrote the code, since I even maintain the code. This code's pretty freaking solid, I gotta say. I just don't have to deal with it very much. It just kind of works. So I add a feature. I say, okay, let's add a column all the way at the left, and it's going to be something that's expandable. So it's going to have, its icon is going to be a wedge. And when you click the wedge, it flips down, and it shows you a list of the most recent 5 items that appeared in the feed, with the title of each item, and next to it, a link, which is again a short date of when that item was posted. And when you hover over the link, it gives you the first, I'm trying to get it to freeze here so I can actually look. This is a bug. Wow. There. I don't know, it's the number of characters. This looks like the first 500 characters in the description, in the body of the story. And that shows up in a pop-up. So you don't have to go anywhere to get the gist of the story. But if you want to read the whole thing, if you click on the date time, it takes you to the full story on the original website. So you're going to the place it appeared. And now I'm going to say a comment. Still talking to the software, by the way. That the comment is that, interestingly, this turns the feed list into a feed reader, and it's a new kind of feed reader. Make a note there that this should go into a blog post, because I should tell people about this. Okay, end of demo. I just programmed in a really high level, and I think it can be a programming language. So, does it matter whether it was Rust or C or JavaScript or Java or COBOL or Fortran or machine language? Or no, I never mentioned anything about any of those things. Did I ever have to get down to saying, you know, okay, this function has to be synchronous and therefore you have to use a callback, but actually I prefer to use async, you know, and promises? Are you kidding me? I didn't hear any of that shit in there. Ask me if I think that ChatGPT could do that today. My guess is that it probably couldn't do that today. Oh, it couldn't do it. Maybe some version they have in the lab could. I'm not getting all the features as a user. $20 a month doesn't get me everything. I mean, if I could, I know I'm rambling a little bit here, but let me just go into this one. If I could have, I don't know how much it would cost, but probably a huge amount of money to get it to remember everything that I said, and so that I could explain these concepts to it and say, here, like, put that in your glossary. That's a object type, and I just defined it, and I want to be able to instantiate that in any application that I develop, so that I never have to explain to you again what an abbreviated date time is. I have a function in my code that does that, by the way. It's not called abbreviated. It's got a really weird, arcane, anachronistic name. I like it. It doesn't matter. I have code that does that. It's easy to define those things. The question is to realize later that you need to give the thing a name so that you can use it in more than one app, and let the software figure that part out. These are things that machines can do. And they're just incredible. They have so much time. They do things so quickly compared to me. They don't make mistakes doing this shit either. I only have so many hours in a day that I can be productive. It doesn't have that limit. It can work. And if it, you know, if it needs more capacity, put it on a faster CPU. Anyway, if I don't think I could afford to get my entire code base into ChatGPT. But also, there's been so much innovation all over the place. I haven't had any time to go look at the other things that are out there. And I know that Microsoft is doing stuff with GitHub. And I got to figure I'm pretty close to being able to use that. The only problem is I use my own editor to write code. And I can't give that up. I love the fucking editor. It's my best editor. I spent years doing that editor. I love it. So can you give me this without forcing me to use a different editor? Then we're in business here. So anyway, if this makes it out as a podcast, let me just say this is just for programmers, basically. If you want to listen off on the side, go ahead, because I think this means that programming is going to definitely be accessible to a lot more people. It just requires, you have to be rigorous in defining these things. It's just like coaxing ChatGPT to draw you a picture. And right now it's going to hallucinate all over the place in the pictures, which is part of the charm of it, actually, to be honest with you. I had to do so many pictures. I kind of like when it just bullshits its way through something. Yeah, I've met plenty of people like that. I don't dislike them as long as we don't have to pretend that stuff is anything but that, you know. But you can't be hallucinating in this business. This part, you know. But I think I mentioned this in another podcast, though, is that as much as you need to be checking these things, I think ultimately it's going to do a better job of testing it than we do. So in other words, okay, we have to look at the results skeptically that come out of these systems and verify that they actually work through rigorous testing. And we know how to do that, by the way. This is like, you know, I'm 50 years into programming, more than that, actually. So yeah, we know how to do the testing. But once we teach it how to do the testing, which I think, my God, I'll bet they're doing that at OpenAI, all right? That's going to do it a lot better than we do it, because it requires a lot of grunt work, and it's a lot of repetitive work. It takes time. These are all the things that we have computers for, and now the computers can do this stuff. That's incredible. The leverage, you know. I wish Doug Engelbart were here to see this. Doug Engelbart would have loved this, because talk about augmentation. Yeah, let's get to the heart of what it means to be a human being. We're getting closer, you know? I think that may be what people are afraid of with this. It's not so much that you're going to, well, I guess some very superficial people only care about whether they get to keep making a living. I know making a living is important, right? But not important, you're making a living isn't all that important to the rest of us, FYI, any more than my making a living is important to you. We've noticed this, by the way, that journalists don't seem to give a shit whether, you know, programmers keep making a living. There are going to be a lot of unemployed programmers around here, by the way. A ton of them. I was trying to explain this to a friend the other day who, I think this is what Vinod Khosla meant. I know Vinod Khosla from my time in California. I have great respect for him. He's a smart guy, right? Probably looks the world pretty much the same way that I do. And we're not talking about philosophy or values here. Just what do you know and what have you learned and what do you see in the new stuff? This is science, basically. This isn't like, you know, liberalism or fascism or any of that shit. It's science, for crying out loud. So when I look at these things, I think how unnecessary was every programming language that we invented in the last 40, 50 years? I mean, for a while, we were pretty conservative about languages. There were like three of them. Really. There were just two, C and Pascal. Well, there were a few others, you know, but they weren't competitive with C and Pascal. There was like database languages, SQL, but that wasn't an alternative to C or Pascal. Today, the proliferation of languages, every big company has created its own language. Why? It got me. I'd love to hear the story. I'd love to have Columbo worked on this one and say, well, why did you have to do one? Why couldn't you just like do the same one? Don't you realize that you're locking your programmers in? Oh, I see. Because if you program in Rust, you can't program it. I mean, you haven't learned anything about programming in Go. Hello. Anyway, it's fascinating. I think we were on the cusp of a huge breakthrough here, and I couldn't be more excited. The fact that I may have a chance to participate in some way in this, this is why I do it. I've had this experience many times in my career, and you know, it's like being a big game hunter in a way. What can I find next? I mean, you know, compare that with, you know, making more money. I heard an interview with James Carville. I have to stop after this and get back to work. But James Carville has had an incredible life. He's in his 80s now. But at a very young age, relatively speaking, he moved to the top of his profession, but more than that, he redefined the profession. And it was one that was worthwhile redefining. And his brain is still all there, and he's highly opinionated. And he said this, he said, what do I need more money for? I'm just like, you know, I don't have to talk. I'm not doing this to make a living. I'm just talking because I want to share what I know. I don't agree with what he did this summer, by the way, where he participated in the, let's get, Joe Biden out of there. I'm not sure in the end that we did ourselves a favor by getting Biden out of there, by the way. Because we still are a racist and sexist and patriarchal society. I'll use all the buzzwords of whatever. But it's a fact. We are. The reason why Biden glided through over Trump is because he met all those objections. People could really feel confident that, okay, it's a white man. We're okay with that. We don't have to think a lot about that. That's just business as usual. I'm not saying I'm one of those people. I voted for Hillary Clinton. I would have voted for anybody but Trump in 2020. It didn't make a difference to me. The question is, what kind of a difference does it make to the racist and genderists in our society? Well, it's enough to make it an easy election versus a pretty frickin' hard one. It's a stretch for people. None of us really understood this with Obama. You know, I thought we were over the race hump in the United States when he was elected. I literally did. I said, God, if Martin Luther King were alive, I bet Jesse Jackson is like beside over the top to see your life's work be accomplished in such a concise way. These things are usually measured in inches, and here we just blew the whole thing out. Right? Now you always have to be careful about that, you know. I wasn't guilty of that when the Soviet Union disintegrated. Everybody said, no, this is the end of history, or we won the Cold War, whatever. I said, I don't think that works that way. The people are still there. The country is still there. The relationships they have, they didn't go anywhere. You know, there's the, God, I'm really going on here. There's the concept of a kitchen table conversation in a house. You know, everybody's sitting around the table and shooting the shit and just talking about whatever. It's boring because everybody's bored. But we do tremendous amounts of that with our parents and to a lesser extent, grandparents. And But the grandparents are always there, and the great-grandparents and the great-great, they're all at the table because that's who taught us what normal was. We inherited their bigotry was passed down. It's our reality. It's what we think is real. And it takes effort to overcome that, to see that in yourself, and then look for other explanations for what you're seeing. And how much of it is inside of you, and how much is it in the other people that are involved. And there are other people involved. You have to get through that too. And they didn't come from the same families you did. So where my family was very persecuted, I think would be the right word for it. That there was a sense that everywhere you looked, it was persecution. That was their explanation for things, especially my mother. Because that's how they began their lives. They were born in one culture and were in a very vulnerable period of their life, were picked up and moved to a completely different one and they ran for their lives, and they were old enough to know that was what was going on, but not old enough to do it. They were being dragged along by their parents because they understood very well what had happened, what was happening. And they all made it, which, if you think about it, has to be that way, right? Because I wouldn't be talking to you if one of my parents' families had been caught and killed, you know? That wouldn't have worked. They all made it, but then they come to the United States, and everywhere they look, they see persecution, and to some extent, they're right. It is there. Anti-Semitism is another kitchen table conversation, where the parents tell them, well, the Jews did this to us. They're the ones that are responsible. How do I know this happened? Because I heard the kids say it when I was growing up. I was ashamed to be Jewish. I thought to be Jewish was dirty. And I had all the stereotypes burned into my brain. Where did that come from? I don't think that came from my parents. Maybe it did. Maybe they had it too, the shame. You know, it's somewhat predictable to think that that if everybody was saying that about you and your family, that you would come to conclusion that there was some truth to what they were saying. I don't know how it works. I don't know how it got in me, but it got in me. The self-loathing that people talk about. Well, we have it. We were taught it. I wouldn't be at all surprised if black people have it too. And I don't want them to feel that way about themselves. I don't want to feel that way about myself. I don't believe any of it is true. I think there are all kinds of Jews. Yeah, all kinds of them. And like most people, they're not always very nice people. But that's true of everybody, you know. I don't know how I got onto this subject, but now we have a two-subject podcast, and I'm going to stop here. And thank you very much for listening. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.